This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are speaking to Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, the Democrat running for governor in Florida this year. We welcome your questions and thoughts for Mayor Gillum. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Glad to hear from some of you across the state of Florida about what you're looking for from the next governor. Larry tweeted, "I hope that when he wins, Mayor Gillum will remember the poorest counties in my former home of the Northwest Florida Panhandle. They may be the reddest parts of Florida, but represent a real opportunity for a Democratic Party reaching out to the working class citizens of our state."
Larry, that is such an important point. And I have to tell you, having just helped to lead my community through the impacts of Hurricane Michael, we had 90% of our power knocked out, thousands of trees come down, roads that were blocked. Within a week, we had 99.5% of people with their power restored, roads cleared, and a sense of normalcy returned to my community. And the first thing we did was dispatch our utility workers to the Western Panhandle, just west of us, to begin that recovery effort for our neighbors. The Gulf Coast region will return, and we will return stronger than ever. But the next governor will help to preside over that restoration. When we are hit with natural disasters, we come together as Floridians. Whether or not politically that is a community that will be for me is of no consequence. They're Floridians, and they're a part of our state that has often been forgotten. Well, the Forgotten Coast will not be forgotten under a Governor Gillum. Not only are we going to see that community restored, we're also going to work with them to help to define an economic future for that region that, again, makes them the pride of the state of Florida.
Before we add one more voice to our conversation, let me follow up with you on that a little bit. One of the conversations that constantly comes up, whether it was after Hurricane Harvey last year, after Hurricane Michael this year, Hurricane Florence earlier, is about the future of these coastal communities. You know, parts of Florida like Mexico Beach and basically the whole Florida coastline all the way around the state are in areas that are very much at risk for rising water levels, Gulf levels, ocean levels, as climate change progresses. And it becomes an increasingly difficult matter as to whether or not people are allowed to live right next to the shore. I mean, you saw the satellite or the drone pictures of homes that were built up to the 2001 building code and homes that weren't. The homes that were standing, and the homes that weren't were toothpicks, basically.
As governor, that's
got to be a tough decision, kind of considering whether or not the state of Florida at a certain point has to tell people, we know you love the ocean, we know you love the Gulf, but it is not safe to live here.
Yeah, no, it's such a fair point. And in fact, speaking about building codes, we may have to revisit our building codes again in light of the fact that we are seeing stronger and more increased storms, particularly up the Gulf where the Gulf waters are so warm.
But then if you tell people where they can't live, that affects the property tax base, that affects the economy. I mean,
well, listen, right now we have the insurer of last resort in this state having to cover homes that are nice and luxurious and, yes, you know, oceanfront properties, but private insurance companies are refusing to write policies there. And so that puts the entire state at risk for having to insure homes that are being built in areas that are increasingly becoming threatened by rising sea levels. So what I would say is that we are deserving of a real statewide conversation, likely county by county, around how it is that we are going to be building more resilient communities that in the face of sea level rise and climate change, that it doesn't make sense in some of these areas that we allow for properties to be built and to be built in, and frankly, in an unresilient way when we know that they are going to be susceptible to being wiped out with these increased storm events and with sea level rise. I can't tell you that there's a panacea. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you in this moment what exact part of the state we would be having to begin this conversation. I think is going to be a statewide conversation, mm-hmm. and it's one that we're going to have to lean into with county and local governments.
I want to reiterate, by the way, we did invite the Republican candidate for Florida Governor Ron DeSantis to take part in this discussion or a future discussion. We have not yet heard back from his campaign, but that invitation stands. We would certainly love to have him on the program. Let's add one more voice to the discussion now, to the questioning now. Joining us from WLRN Public Radio in Miami is Luis Hernandez, who's the host of its daily talk show, Sundial. Luis, welcome to 1A.
Joshua, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And Mayor, again, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. I do want to note that 31 of 67 counties in Florida have started early voting, and the counties, most of the counties here in the WLRN listening area, including Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami-Dade counties, have begun early voting. Mr. Mayor, it looks as though Republicans are going to hold the Florida House and Senate. So how do you plan to get any of your ideas through if the opposing party is in control of the two chambers?
Well, one, Luis, good to hear your voice again. Two, am well aware and thankful for your reminder of the early voting. We actually had some of our supporters who overnighted last night watching the debate and were the first in line to vote down in Miami for early voting. But to your question, one, I am not drawing the conclusion that Republicans will hold the Senate. I think they will likely be in position to hold the House, but I think Democrats will get some gains. That being said, we will have a divided government. I would say this. I think what we've got to look to are where are the areas where we might be able to find some cooperation. I mentioned earlier that I thought criminal justice reform was one area where we might be able to bring Democrats and Republicans together to help get a salve, a solution that might lead to saving money and modernizing a system that is in desperate need of update. And I will tell you, I'm willing and prepared to work with what might be a speaker, Oliva. He and I spent some time together for 2 years making our way through an Aspen Institute fellowship where we got to know each other pretty well. Now, I don't take that to mean that I'm going to convince him to believe in everything I believe or vice versa. But I definitely think that we begin from a place where we don't think of each other as, you know, arch enemies, if you will. We're sent there to do the bidding, to do the job of the people of the state. And it's my hope to find areas where we can work together, maybe on affordable housing, maybe on dealing with health care in some ways. Can I convince them that it makes sense to pull down that $6 billion for health care, which is for the state of Florida, one of the most exploding parts of our budget? So I'm not beyond working with the other party. I also don't draw the conclusion that you have to be of the same party in order to work together. You will probably recall that there were a number of sessions where Governor Rick Scott couldn't get his budget through, and he shared the same party with the Speaker of the House and with the Senate President. So there may be some benefit, in my opinion, to negotiating and to them negotiating with me and trying to find solutions. I know Floridians are tired of us getting nothing done. They want their government to work for them, and they're not interested in our partisan, you know, squabbles. They want to make sure that we can produce.
And you mentioned a couple of different things there. One I wanted to approach you on is the criminal justice issue. You've been public about the fact that your family had run-ins with the law in both Miami-Dade County and when you went to Gainesville. Yeah. One of your brothers was arrested on drug trafficking charges. You've made criminal justice reform one of the critical points of your campaign for governor.
Yeah.
How did your family's experience with the law at a young age inform these proposals for updating the state's criminal justice system?
Yeah, I mean, so first, I mean, it shaped it a lot. I think if you recall from my opening video when I introduced myself, I talked a bit about, you know, watching my mother, you know, tears well up in her face when, you know, the cop would come by the house and say, you know, your son's in trouble again, right? That's a difficult thing for any child to have to see and experience. And I remember deciding at a very early age that I never wanted to see that expression on my mom's face because of something that I did. And so I am the first of my seven siblings to graduate from high school, and as the fifth of seven kids and the first to graduate from college. When my brother got home after doing his time, I watched him want to be a better father for his daughter and a better partner to his girlfriend and then to his wife. And he went and applied for job after job after job and got told no after no after no. And it really did shape my belief that, listen, how can we say we want people to pull themselves up by the bootstrap, to redeem themselves, to reintroduce themselves into society when we then create all of these barriers that keep them from being able to do just that? And so, you know, as a mayor, I led the effort to ban the box in my city. We don't ask about criminal background history unless answering yes is a disqualifier for the position. If it's not, We're going to measure people off their merit. Are you skilled? Are you qualified? Can you do the work? And what we've learned is that these individuals happen to be some of the hardest working people we have within our government because they know what it means to be without. And if we're serious about trying to reintroduce people into society, then we've got to think about what are those ways that we can give people dignity that comes with work again. Because once they've had access to a job where they can earn an honest wage and honest living and to be a good example for our communities, it helps us at our crime rate level, because the best way to control crime is to reduce the amount of people reoffending. It's important, and it's played a big role in my thinking around criminal justice reform writ large.
Mayor Gillum, one of the key ways that some are proposing to reintegrate folks back into society has to do with the ballot initiative coming up next month. It would give formerly incarcerated people their voting rights back in the state of Florida. Now, former Attorney General Eric Holder has spoken out about this issue before. Here's part of what he has said.
In many states, felony disenfranchisement laws are still on the books. And the current scope of these policies is not only too significant to ignore, it is also too unjust to tolerate. Across this country today, an estimated 5.8 million Americans, 5.8 million of our fellow citizens, are prohibited from voting because of current or previous felony convictions. Now, that's more than the individual populations of 31 United States, 31 of our states.
That's former Attorney General Eric Holder. Now, I understand that there's tremendous support for this item among some voters. Other voters, Mayor Gillum, are a little hesitant, kind of wondering whether there needs to be another step before ex-felons are able to vote again, whether there are certain circumstances under which felons should still lose their voting rights for life. How do you view it?
Well, you know, this constitutional amendment, Amendment 4, already makes certain carve-outs for individuals, sexual violence offenders and others who have, you know, committed certain crimes where there is still a process for them to have their rights restored. But in the state of Florida, we've got 1.6, 1.7 million people who have had their right to vote permanently taken away from them. Florida is only one of, what, four states that still have this throwback policy on the books. When it passes, and God knows I hope it does, we will immediately re-enfranchise almost a million people in this state. But that's just the first step. I do believe that they ought to have their rights restored. But we're then going to also have to look to, how do we make sure that these folks have the ability to work? How do we ensure that we integrate them into society where they are able to meet, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, food, water, shelter, security? Because if they can't, many of them will make a U-turn. And I think what we want to do is prevent that U-turn by making sure that people have access to, again, jobs and skills and are able to become contributing members to society again.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Before we get to Luis with the next question, we're getting a number of questions from, well, first of all, let me get to a comment from Jillian, who tweeted, I am a registered Republican voting for Mayor Gillum in the hopes of drawing people away from party extremes and into a practice of functioning democratically for the good of the people. We got a number of folks who asked this question. Michael emailed, would you ask your guest if there is any truth to the reports that he intends to implement a state tax? Mayor Gillum, Florida has no state income tax. Is that something you would change?
Oh, God. No, I'm so thankful for that question, by the way. My opponent has taken, his campaign has taken to sending text messages to voters suggesting that I will implement a state income tax. So let me be very clear here. One, I am not in favor of a state income tax, and a state income tax in the state of Florida is prohibited by Florida Constitution. A governor actually could not implement a state income tax here in the state of Florida.
You'd have to put it on the ballot, basically.
Well,
you'd have to amend the Constitution,
Right, but I could not, as the governor, unilaterally implement a state income tax, and I'm not proposing to do so. What we have proposed, by the way, in the state of Florida, the corporate income tax, which does exist here, only 3% of companies in the state of Florida pay the corporate income tax. 97% of companies in the state of Florida pay no corporate income tax at all. LLCs and S-Corps don't pay the corporate tax rate, and I'm not proposing to change that either. either. What we're proposing is for the 3% of the wealthiest companies in the state of Florida, 3%, the ones that pay the corporate tax rate, that they will pay $1 billion more in corporate taxes. And where does that billion come from? Right now, under the tax realignment under the Trump administration, that same 3% walked away with $6.3 billion of our money. When they reduced the tax burden from 35% down to 20%, that equated to $6.3 billion for that 3%. What we are simply saying is they can keep $5.3 billion of that money ongoing and increasing into whatever, so long as those taxes, which were made permanent, mm-hmm. exist for them. But we want $1 billion of that to come into the state of Florida so that we can pay teachers a salary they can live on, and that we can reintroduce into our public education system the kind of apprenticeships that used to exist in Florida. Woodwork, okay. Shop, mechanical, electrical, technical, right. All of those kinds of programs that allowed our kids to get a skill that they could monetize, go to work, get a job, and earn a good wage. It's a win-win. Because we are training their next generation workforce.
Let me get to one comment about that very briefly, and then Luis, I know we got time for about one more question from you. With regards to what you were just referring to, Wanda emailed for you to explain what she wrote as the $1 billion tax increase proposed by him and cited in his opponent's commercials. Wanda writes, "I'm a Republican who is leaning to voting Democratic in the midterms, but a $1 billion tax increase gives me pause." So that's what the mayor just explained.
And again, that's what I want folks to be clear on. This is our money, right? This is these were public dollars that used to go into the federal system, mm-hmm. obviously, which also winds its way down into the states, that were given away to the wealthiest corporations and the wealthiest 1%. And guess what? Look, you know what? Elections have consequences. That it passed, the president pushed it, it made its way through Congress. But here in the state of Florida, we have a crisis. The state of Florida is ranked, its public education system is ranked 40th out of 50th in quality.
Right.
The increase per pupil spending in my state was 43 cents last year. 43 cents. Our teachers in the state of Florida are paid the 45th lowest average salary of all 50 states. Now, listen. I don't want to pay any more than anybody else, and we won't under any of my tax proposals, including for those corporations. They will pay less under a Governor Gillum than they pay under a Governor Scott. But if we're trying to be a leading state, then we can't have companies saying, I can't come to the state of Florida because I can't get the talent that I need in that state to fill the jobs that we're creating. We're the third largest state in America. It should not be our challenge that we can't produce the talent that we need for the workforce that we've got to build.
Hey, Mayor Gillum.
We've got to pay for it.
Mayor Gillum, I know I promised Luis Hernandez one more question. Can you stay around for like 2 minutes after the break and answer a few more questions? Would that be all right? Good. Thank you. We'll get to Luis Hernandez's next question. Luis Hernandez from WLRN in Miami, as we continue with more of your questions for Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum running for Florida governor. Stay close.